This Restorative Justice Life is a production of Amplify RJ. Follow us on all social media platforms at Amplify RJ, sign up for our email list, and check out our website at amplifyrj.com to stay up to date on everything we have going on. Make sure you're subscribed to this feed on whatever platform you're listening on right now so you don't miss an episode. And finally, we'd love it if you left us a rating and review. It really helps us literally amplify this work. Thanks for listening. Enjoy the episode. Welcome to This Restorative Justice Life, the podcast that explores how the philosophy, practices, and values of restorative justice apply to our everyday lives. I'm your host, David Ryan Barcega Castro Harris, all five names for the ancestors, and I'm the founder of Amplify RJ. On this podcast, I talk with RJ practitioners, circle keepers, and others doing this work about how this way of being has impacted their lives. I'm going to make this intro short because today's episode is our longest yet. Even after talking with the Reverend Dr. Robert Spicer about the restorative justice work he's done in schools, community, the White House, and beyond for 2 hours, we're definitely going to have him back in the future to talk about the work he's done around aspirational justice and all the other stories we didn't get to. I would say we wanted to give you this longer episode to accompany you on your holiday travels, but I imagine most of you aren't traveling this Thanksgiving. Speaking of Thanksgiving, if you're an educator or caregiver looking for a way to talk about Thanksgiving with the kids in your life in a way that's honoring the indigenous people of this land, Hunkpapa Lakota educator Helen Thomas, our guest from episode 4 of this podcast, held a workshop sharing resources and lessons plans for decolonizing Thanksgiving for kids of all ages. You can find the replay and resources at the link in the description, and our other offerings, including our self-paced Intro to RJ online course and our new cohort of Foundations of Restorative Justice hybrid 8-hour course starting on November 23. Okay, so maybe this wasn't so short, but I won't keep you waiting any longer. Let's get into our conversation with Robert Spicer. Welcome, Robert. Who are you?
I'm a father of 4 beautiful children. I love them dearly. Robert from a previous marriage. Bethany, Brianna, and Bria. And so, and then I'm a pet parent too. I got my 3 dogs. So Blossom, Blue, and Barky. So all 3, everybody got bees up in the house. Mm. They're my bee's knees. So yes, I'm a parent.
Who are you?
I'm also a husband of 11 years to my darling wife, Chandra Smart Spicer. During this pandemic, as many families, we've all had to adjust and shift. But what's been beautiful has been the consistency of love between us and through this very tumultuous and difficult time. So yeah. That's also who I am.
Who are you?
I'm a teacher at heart, having taught in both the elementary and the high school level as a dean of students at Christian Finger High School, and then as an elementary school teacher, third grade, at Sojourner Truth Elementary School, on 2 distinctive sides of the city, one on the north side, Sojourner Truth, and one on the far south side. So I'm a teacher.
Who are you?
I'm also a pastor. I've had the distinct opportunity to pastor in a church. I was a co-pastor in one church, then transitioned to the senior pastor in another church, and then transitioned back to being a co-pastor or minister. At the current church that I'm at right now, I feel that pastoring is a huge part of who I am and helps me to navigate a lot of these different challenges that we face in the world today. So I'm a pastor, minister.
Who are you?
I'm also a restorative justice practitioner. Having done this work all my life, didn't know what I was doing. When I first started as a young man, but little did I know that those were the seeds that would one day grow into this oak tree in my life, this this huge passion of mine as a practitioner of the work, as a strategist of the work, as a teacher of the work, and also as a disciple of the work of restorative justice. I also feel like I'm still a student as well. So I'm always learning. I'm always trying to figure out new ways, and I'm always, you know, trying to do the best I can to glean from others that have been doing this work for many, many years. And then as well, learning from the children who are amazing and being able to really see possibility in this incredible work. So I'm a restorative justice practitioner.
Who are you?
I'm the son of Cavalier Alexander Spicer and Faye Agnes Yvonne Edwards, two immigrant parents from the Caribbean who found each other in the late 60s, got married, and then subsequent after my birth, divorced, but did their very best to co-parent myself and my older brother, Cavalier Alexander Spicer Jr. And I'm blessed to still have them here on the land of the living. They're seniors, they're grandparents, of course. One is in Atlanta, my father, and the other is in Texas, my mother. She remarried. She's still with her husband over 40 years, Mr. Claude Nelson. And they have from their union, my sister Nicole. And she has two beautiful children, Shania and Nathaniel. And, of course, my brother, he has his sons, Messiah and Justin. And, of course, as I told you, I have Robert and my three daughters, excuse me, and my pets.
Absolutely.
But, yes, I'm a son, which carries a huge responsibility for me as I'm moving into my middle ages. Still being nurtured and loved by my parents. Still blessed to have them here in my life. And still encouraging me to do the best that I can, to be the best that I can, and to do what I got to do until I can do what I want to do. So,
right.
I'm a son.
And finally, who are you?
Well, I'm a Chicagoan. Wasn't born here, but I've lived here for over 25 years, owned my house for over 20 years. And I've seen the best of this great city, and I've also seen the struggle of this great city. I was born in New York, and so New Yorkers, we have a different, you know, kind of spin on things and how we see the world, how we view things. But I was sitting in my backyard yesterday just thinking about being a Chicagoan and what that means, what that brings when you say that you're a Chicagoan. You're someone that is a part of this whole notion of a city of big shoulders and you know, the Windy City. But I like the big shoulders because it's this whole notion of strength. And the one thing that I've gained being in the city of Chicago all these years is a sense of purpose and strength and courage. And the people that I've worked with have lifted me up on those big shoulders. Chicago has lifted me up many times on their big shoulders. And have encouraged me to continue to do the work that I'm doing, not only here in Chicago and Illinois, this great state, but also nationally, as a strategist for restorative strategies. So I have to say that, you know, on the seventh one, I have to say that I'm a Chicagoan, whether they like it or not. I'm here to stay. I know I didn't go to none of your high schools. No, I didn't go to none of your elementary schools. No, I didn't. My parents weren't born here, nor are they from the South of America. But they are from the South, but they're from further South. The islands, father from Jamaica, mother from Guyana, South America. And my time in New York was important. It was formative. But I have to say, in terms of the work that I'm doing and the way that I am and the man that I am, Chicago definitely formed me, helped me to become the man that I am and that I'm evolving to become as I grow older. So yes, I would have to say I'm a Chicagoan.
Yeah. Thank you so much. I haven't really acknowledged this in a lot of the other episodes, but think over half of the podcast guests so far are from Chicago or have made home in Chicago. We normally start off asking about like your journey with restorative justice, but I'm curious, what makes Chicago so important to doing this work for you?
The people. So I gotta say, the people. I think what drew our former president here, right? It was the people. And what kept him here and what helped him to find his wife as I found mine is the people. There's a long history of organizing here in this city. And I wasn't drawn to the city because of organizing. I was drawn to the city to become a teacher. And teaching is what I did. But what I noticed about the people of Chicago is when there's an issue or there's a problem, they are not ashamed to talk about it. They're not ashamed to get in your face and tell you this is wrong and that we have to change it. They're not afraid to get in the mix and to get dirty, to see our children be safe and to see our families be safe. And that courage is infectious. That courage is inspiring. And it's something that I aspire to become as a young man in my former home of New York. In the NAACP Youth Council, where during those formative years, I learned all about organizing, voting rights, our long march to freedom as African Americans. All that was distilled into us, and as well as youthful things that we were allowed to do to express who we are as youth during those 80s and moving into the 90s. And so when I got to Chicago, they gave me a form and a platform to be able to express that side of myself that otherwise would have just laid dormant if I didn't have a city and a group of people that really appreciated men and women that are willing to stand up and speak truth to power. So I just feel, you know, that it's in the water, it's in the air, it's in the way Chicago is from the Haymarket riots and, you know, all the organizers done, Dr. King coming and fighting for, you know, equal rights and housing and, you know, just the ancestors laid in this city, this space, a very potent, ubiquitous power around organizing and around people power and around taking your souls literally out into the streets, whether it's voting, whether it's organizing a march at Union Park, whether it's striking, whether it's unions, whatever it is. Here in Chicago, for some reason, the people here are very courageous and very prone to organizing and activism. You know, they don't just organize, they activate and they move out into the streets or they move into the areas of political spaces specific to, you know, making decisions. They're not afraid. And I'm grateful to be a part of that history in my little small role and the work that we've been able to do to really change the way that schooling, potentially policing, potentially urban planning, you know, this is like there it is endless what can be created in a space like this and how this space affects the whole United States and the world because it's a, you know, very large city. So, yeah, that's something that I'm proud to talk about. And then when I read the history, I'm like, oh, no wonder
right,
Chicago's
right.
Like this. And it's not Denver, right? Or it's not, San Diego, or it's not Tampa, right? No wonder Chicago specifically is the way it is. It has a long history of being a strong proponent of organizing, standing up for the rights of the little guy. And I'm very excited to be a part of that.
Yeah, something that often comes up when doing this work is this idea of like both the warrior and the healer, right? And you said that you've been doing restorative justice work a lot longer than you knew the word restorative justice. In your own words, how did that get started for you?
I think it got started from my first physical fight that I lost. And I made a vow to myself that I would never raise my hand to hit anybody. I would never use violence as a form of expression or say that it's right to do, and that I would find peaceful ways to deal with the myriad of issues that were going to come my way. Because once you say that I'm going to stand for peace, you know every temptation, every issue, every bully, everybody's coming to test you to see if you truly are who you say you are. And I can safely say that I've never even struck my children, you know, in discipline, because I just didn't feel like in my heart that that was the right way to deal with issues and problems. There are better ways. And little did I know that that was restorative justice, but I had no idea what it was. I just knew that that was just not fighting and fists and all that, guns and all. Wasn't me. I wasn't going to the Army. My father was pushing me, go to the Navy, go into service. I was like, I wouldn't be a good soldier, because I'm not someone that's about violence and about hurting and maiming or killing anybody. Just that's not me. And this path was begun at that moment when I was, I would say about 6 years old, right? That was like my first fight, 6, 7 years old, that I lost. And I've lost many other fights. You know, I had fights in junior high school, nothing in high school. But that, I think junior high school was the last, like, physical fight. And it was interesting because the fight wasn't even about me. It was about somebody else that this particular person wanted to get to. But they knew that they couldn't just go to that person. They would use me as, like, the tool. Because they knew that that guy was going to come to the fight to see it. And then when the opportunity presented himself, he got me. And then he went and got the other dude. I mean, he was a superstar for a while. He beat up two people. And he was a short little statured dude. But he knew karate. He knew all that physical stuff. So it made up in my mind. It solidified in my mind that I was going to be a peaceful man. And I just grew into that. You know, doesn't mean I don't get angry. We all get angry, get frustrated and whatnot. But violence was not the way in which I operated. And that didn't mean, like I just told you, that didn't mean that violence was not going to show up, right? Like, incidences weren't going to show up. I was still getting, you know, whoopings, right, as a kid. I was still, you know, violence was still talked harshly to. All that was still happening. But I was forming in my head what type of parent I wanted to be, what type of man I wanted to be. And I'm grateful that I chose that decision because it guided me into the path, into the work that I'm in right now as a restorative justice practitioner. Because zero tolerance is like a belt, you know. It forces individuals who have that power to meet that power onto someone that's weaker. And using zero tolerance, I saw was wrong. And then when I saw the numbers and saw that it was mostly African-American, Latinx, those that were LGBT designated and those that had special education or 504 plans, it was not only wrong, but it was also racist. And so, you know, the whole point of what you said about being a warrior and a healer. So there has to be a balance that has to be struck. One of my colleagues, Margaret Hughes, once talked about this whole notion of the warrior, the samurai warrior, who is also a gardener as well. So he can fight, but he can also gently go into a garden and actually, you know, prune the trees and do all those things and make a good cup of tea. She always would say that part, and I remembered that. I know I'm paraphrasing what she would say, but she would say that, and that would always make me chuckle. Because that's who we were, like, or who we are, excuse me. We're not punks. Like, you know, just because we say we're about peace doesn't mean we're not willing to fight. But our fighting is not the way you think the fighting should be. The fighting is a whole nother force. As Dr. King talked about, a soul force, a move of the spirit that overwhelms the physical notions of using brutality to get your point across. Because now we're touching a side of you that is endless. A side of you that is built on good and that's built on the relationship building that we all aspire to become and be. Even if we disagree, we don't have to be disagreeable in our disagreements, right? Just because you don't eat at my table doesn't mean that you can't eat, right? You can eat wherever you want to eat. but you just can't eat at my table. It's okay. So it's this whole notion of being the warrior as well as being the healer and striking that balance. And sometimes we do, you know, we set a goal to strike the balance. Sometimes we do good and sometimes we don't. And in that process, we're constantly doing reviews, after action reviews of how we approach certain things so that we can make sure that we do better the next time as we're given a chance to, because every day is precious and every hour, every minute, every second is precious. And whenever we're given a chance, we go forth and we do the work with that whole notion that we have to strike a balance. But my general walk, of course, is different from your walk and different from other walks of how we got to this point, how I got to this platform with you, and how the work is still continuing, still moving forward. But I'm always excited to hear those stories of how people came to this work. Bob Marley tells a story about, you know, they asked him, you know, how you come to Rastafarianism? How did that come about? And he always says, you know, I was always a Rasta. It's always. I just grew into it. It was always in me. So I just grew into it. And then my dreadlocks and my music expresses what was always in my heart. And I feel that way about restorative justice. It was always in me. It was conceived in me. And so that whole notion of moving into the work was not a hard move. It was a natural progression, a natural evolution.
You talked about how you, after losing that fight, you decided for yourself that you weren't going to get in any more fights. And you talked about how you were actively against, like, participating in the military-industrial complex. And now you're reflecting as a middle-aged man with all the wisdom that you have. But can you think of another time, maybe in your younger life, where you held the tension of warrior and healer?
I guess it would have to be being raised in my house and that tension of living in a blended family, being under specific rules, having my father as a weekend dad as opposed to being in the house with us, having another man, you know, meet discipline and speak in certain ways. All of that formed, and then having a mother who was gentle, kind, loving, and trying her very best to place into us morals and integrity and those things that we need to make ourselves prepared to be leaders in our homes, leaders in our communities, and leaders on our workplace. I think all of those informed my decision-making around how I wanted to be as a man, at the bedrock of who I am. And I can look back on those experiences and those moments living in that household and realize that the even type of father that I am to my stepchildren has a direct correlation to how I felt, how I was feeling growing up in that environment. And I'm grateful for it, that I was able to make a distinction between the type of person that was speaking to me and sharing certain information with me and the type of man that I become, being able to refute a lot of that stuff as a kid, saying, I don't believe that. Nope. I don't believe that. Nope. I don't have to do that. I can do that as a child. And I got whooped a lot. because, you know, you call that defiance, you call that adolescence, I call that forming who you are becoming. That's what I call it. You know, Michelle Obama writes in her, you know, shares in her book about becoming, that whole process of her becoming who she is and all the different steps that she had to take on that road from the South Side of Chicago to the White House and beyond, and that we're constantly becoming. And I think that that process of being raised in my particular household, you know, gave me that awareness that this was the type of man I want to be. And it was a direct refutation of what I was experiencing at that particular time. And so, of course, I was picking up messages from The Cosby Show. I was picking up messages from Father Knows Best. I was picking up messages from my own father. I was picking up messages from my stepfather. I was picking up messages from all the men that were around me. And those messages informed what type of man I wanted to be to the children I'll be blessed to raise, or in my case, because I want to be an educator, the hundreds of children that I would that I would teach over the course of my 25 years time as an educator. And so I think all of those things inform the healer portion. The warrior portion is a part of my DNA. I did one of those DNA companies, AfricanAncestry.com, and found out that my family, from my mother's side, are from the Mandinka tribe. And the Mandinka are located in the southern part of Senegal. And these men and women were warriors. When the English version or the English, sharing of that or saying of that particular, group, they call them Mandingo, but they call Mandinka. And they also are storytellers, griots, as they call them. Kunta Kinte is from that particular, he's from the Gambia, which is not just right there, you know, connected to Senegal, it's inside of Senegal. But he was taken from that area, and he is also Mandinka. And I feel like that warrior side of me comes from my ancestral home of Africa and being a Mandinka. And I'm glad I'm touching on that because I was watching a program where Samuel Jackson also did his DNA and found his roots. But his show is looking at the ships that didn't make it. And we don't think about that. We hear about those that committed suicide, jumped off the ship, you know, all type of terrible things happened in the Middle Passage, the Maafa, as it's called by Dr. Marimba Ani. Great devastation beyond human recognition. But in spite of all of that, my warrior ancestor made it to South America and survived and thrived and moved forward. And so I feel like that warrior spirit of survival and that warrior spirit of being able to conquer very difficult situations, but not using violence. That's where the healer comes in, right? So using another way, another technique, speaks to the two sides. And, of course, my growing up in the family that I grew up in and growing up with my father being a weekend dad and all the things that came with it, and oh boy, all of that stuff informed who I am. I can look back on it now and I can say, that was bad. It wasn't a lot of good, it wasn't a lot of bad, it wasn't a lot of good, it was life. But I can appreciate the meat and I can throw away the bones, if you understand what I mean by that. You know, I can really take from it the sustenance now and appreciate it, as opposed to, you know, cursing at the wind and being angry at those people that harmed me, being angry at the bullies that bullied me and not having the help that I felt like I needed from my brothers and others, my stepfather, who was the one that was there, you know, just feeling like I was, you know, in the middle, you know. At some points, it's feeling like I couldn't breathe, like what we hear our young people saying. But I found a way, and I think that's what is in us as warriors. You got to figure it out and you got to find a way. And at the same time, be able to recognize that you need to be healed as well. You need to reconcile those things that happened to you in your past. You need to forgive those people. You really do. You got to forgive them, not just for yourself, not just for them, but for yourself. Because if you don't, then you're going to continue to harbor that bitterness and that anger, shame, guilt, and it's not going to help you to be effective in the work of restorative justice. So I always talk to my, you know, colleagues, you know, to make sure you're doing that self-care. If you have a therapist, man, talk to that therapist as much as possible. Make sure you're taking care of your health. Make sure you're taking care of, you know, your emotional state. Making sure that you're having that spiritual connection. Make sure all those elements of the medicine wheel are active and activated so that you could be at peak state. So when you're sitting in circle or when you're doing any restorative measure, you're able to really be present with the people that are there. And so over my years, that's what I've attained to do and try to set a goal to make sure that I touch those four areas of the medicine wheel as much as possible. And I'm becoming more and more aware of the mental and the emotional, and how that unseen area of our lives has such an effect on the seen area, which is our physical.
Absolutely. You talked about how, you know, you've channeled a lot of this over the years into the work that you've done with children and in education. How did that start, and how did that look?
Well, as a third grade teacher, I had the blessing to work under a very progressive principal. Her name was Pernicia Pugh. Her school was located in Chicago. I don't think I told your audience this, but I was a Morehouse graduate. I am a Morehouse graduate. And so a gentleman that was from Chicago was working with this particular school, doing some, you know, doing some progressive work. And, you know, I was looking for a job at the time, and he said, well, you know, you're interested in education. The school appears looking for men. If you're willing to come to Chicago, you may have a shot. I'll put in a good word for you. And, you know, I made that leap, you know, from living in my mama's house to living on and off campus in Atlanta to then coming to the Midwest. The best decision I made at the time in my life was to make that leap to come to this very beautiful city. And being in that classroom, I would have to say it was 9/11, September 11th, 2001. That began my real understanding of relationship building with our children. See, as an educator, when you're young, you have older educators mentoring you. And they told me, look, if you show any weakness to these children, I was working in an area that was located on the north side of Chicago, an area called Cabrini Green. It's where they filmed, or they got the idea for Good Times. It was Good Times. There was a lot of bad times too. If you know anything about that community, they had gangs, rivals fighting each other. Children were getting shot and killed. A lot of, poverty, a lot of hopelessness, a lot of drug addiction. And here I was thrown into this environment and asked as a man to teach these babies. I was teaching third graders, 8 years old. And so I listened to this mentor teacher. This was my first teaching gig. And so I was like, okay. So I was like, you know, I showed a little bit, but I was trying to be as stern as possible. And they didn't even know I had teeth until June. That's when I smiled and gave them the report card and said, all right, yeah, have a good day. Oh, Mr. Spicer got teeth. Get out of here. You know, so they knew I had emotion. So I was trying to keep it pretty even throughout. And then September 11th, 2001 hit. And so, as I told you, my family's from New York. And so I got to work a little late. Everybody was around the little black and white TVs and on their little radios. We didn't have all the cell phones and stuff at that time. And they were like, yo, something's happening in your city. I was like, what? This was when the first plane hit, 8:58. So I got in like maybe, you know, usually you're supposed to get there at 8:30. So I was a little late, something, I don't know, with the train or something. So I was a little late. So I was rushing. I was trying to get my kids and stuff. And I was like, yo, something happened to see. So I was like, man, I gotta run, you know, get my kids. Like, no, you got to see this. And I looked at the TV and the first plane had already hit. And so I'm looking at the TV. And then 9:05, the second plane hits. And we all were in shock. We were like, oh my gosh, what's happening? So of course my mind was like, I got to call my parents. You know, I got to make sure that my family members, because I had a lot of family still in the city. So I had my little Verizon phone. You know, I didn't have the little phone I have now, a little Verizon phone. You're not supposed to use your phone, right? So I had to kind of hide. Got the kids up. Got them upstairs. They asked me questions. Why were you late? What's going on? I was like, nothing. Just be quiet. Come on. That particular group of kids were the lower functioning kids. They were kind of the rougher kids that I had that particular year. So I was as stern as you could be, these young people. And I get them in the room, and I go immediately to the closet to hang up my coat. But then while I was in the closet, I had the door open. I just kind of started calling to see if I can get in touch with anybody. Couldn't get in touch with anybody. I didn't know that the Verizon tower had went down, right, because of all the stuff. I couldn't get in touch with anybody. It was just busy signal. So I panicked and I started showing emotions, started crying. And one of the kids, Antoine, he saw me. He was the leader of the class. He saw me. He saw something was wrong with Mr. Spicer. So what he ended up doing was get all the kids and he got them over to the little reading rug and started doing the morning meeting. Morning meeting was something that we do every morning. What's today's date? And he, I don't know how he found my little pointer, but he pulled out my pointer. He got all the kids sitting down and he started going over his thing. What's today? September 11th. Good. What planet are we on? They were like, Jupiter. No, we on Earth. And he said, point to it. You know, he's doing me. He's doing me. They're kids, but he's doing me. And I'm hearing this. I'm crying, but I'm hearing him taking stock of my class. Going through the meeting. All right, let's do the timetables. Did the timetables. Did the thing. So he finally got to the end part. And the end part is like kind of a little mantra that we say to kind of get ourselves pepped up. And the boy knew the mantra. Said the mantra. They said it back to him. And I'm sitting there like shocked that he's running my class because I never told anybody to do anything. I was just dealing with the moment of I can't get in touch with my parents. And so I felt these little fingers grab my hand. I looked down. It's Antoine. And he said, Mr. Spicer, could you come over to the reading rug? And so he takes me over to the reading rug. And the kids now see me. They see the tears coming down my eyes. So they're like, oh, something's really going on. And they sit me down in the rocking chair. And Antoine picks up the book that he can read. I told you, these are low-functioning kids. So the book that he could read was a picture book called No David. And No David was basically about a special ed child who was just doing a lot of stuff, tearing up stuff, doing a lot of crazy stuff in the house, doing a lot of stuff. And he was me. I was sitting in my rocking chair, but he was me. So he was down on the floor reading the storybook and showing the kids the pictures. And he was like, okay, what's your favorite page? They said, oh, that page. Why? Because he's naked running outside. And I did that one time. I got a whooping and all the kids laughed and stuff. Tried to make me, you know, come up because they could see I was sad. And so they went through the book. They closed the book. Now we're sitting in a circle. Sitting in a circle. They closed the book. They put the book down. And in a round, like this is before I knew anything about what I was going to be doing, each child said something positive to me. And they started to get emotional because they saw me get emotional. For a lot of them, it was the first time they ever had a male teacher. For a lot of them, some of them, they don't have their fathers. A lot of their fathers were locked up. Or uncles or whomever, male figure. So I was a male figure. And for the first time in their life, they're seeing this man cry. A man cry. Like, they're not accustomed to this. So they felt like the best way to deal with this was to talk to me and to speak positive energy into me. And then it went around the circle. I had about 25 kids. So it went all the way around. Some kids spoke. Some kids didn't. Some kids just cried. They just sat and cried because they saw me cry and it just affected them. And then it got to me, and then I shared with them what was going on. I told them that there was a terrorist attack here in America. I told them that two of the largest buildings in our United States was destroyed, and thousands of people have died, and I can't get to my mom and my dad. And so they heard all of that. But what struck them was me telling them that I had a mom and a dad. They couldn't even fathom it. They just thought they just put me together at the board and just sent me to the school. They thought I lived there in the room because there was a sink and there was a little, you know, area and a little closet. They said, oh, you live here, you know, this is your other house.
Right.
When I began to share with them and tell them, you know, that I had family, they began to talk about their family and how much they loved their family and how scared they were for America and for themselves. They were like, we got a big building here. I mean, you could look out my window and there was a Sears Tower. And so they were like, are they going to attack us? And I said, well, if anything happens, I'm not leaving you. I'm pretty sure your parents will come get you, but whatever's going to happen, they're going to have to come through me to get to you. So don't worry about it. And one of the kids said, can we hug you? And that's like a taboo. You're not supposed to hug the kids. You're not supposed to touch mm-hmm. them. It's taboo. But I needed a hug at that moment. And all the children needed a hug. So we all got up and we got in the middle of the circle, and we all just did a collective hug. Somebody pinched my butt, and I said, "Who did that?" I turned around, "Who pinched my butt?" And they all laughed. And then we went to our seats, and we did the best we could to go through the rest of the day. But I'm gonna tell you that all those children raised up their reading levels, their math levels. I didn't have no problem with those children after that date, other than little hiccups. But other than that, our relationship became so solidified, so solid that the kids from that class still communicate with me via, you know, Facebook or any of the other ways, just checking in on me. Some of them are parents now, and some of them said, you know, that day changed my life. And the way that I parent, the way that I operate is because of how you operated at that time when we were kids. And so that was the beginning. That was the onboarding for what the work that I was going to be pursuing, not just the academic, which is very important, and high stakes testing and zero times, all that was on full steam in 2001. But I also realized that there was something else that we were missing, and that something else was the restorative, the social emotional.
Right, so, the relationships, the interconnection, the vulnerability, right? You when you close yourself off to be like, oh, I'm just this stone-faced, hard teacher, respect, learn, you don't have that connection. And it took like one of the biggest tragedies in recent history to bring that humanity out of you for them, right? Not just that, you know, you don't live here. You have a mom and dad, but, you know, you feel things too. You're scared about things too, just like they're scared about lots of things going on as an 8-year-old living in Cabrini Green, yep, right?
Absolutely. And they shared their fears, their police raids, and seeing people OD in the stairwell, and, you know, people falling down the elevator shaft. Like, their fears and their things that they had to navigate, no other child, I don't think, in America had to navigate, but they were navigating it. And now some of them are successful in the work that they're doing all over the United States. They still have trauma. They still have, you know, things that come, vestiges of that experience, and they're getting the help for that. But what I'm grateful for is the fact that that principal, Pernicia Pugh, was so progressive in ensuring that there would be men that would be teaching. A lot of those children, I was their first teacher, and they didn't get another male teacher till high school. So it was like an anomaly that they got to be in Robert Spicer's class for those years that I was teaching in that elementary school, close to 10 years. And it made a difference in a lot of their lives. And some of them had to go a hard way. Some of them got caught up in stuff. But for the most part, a lot of those children. And when I started teaching, she made the class an all-male class. So I was teaching all. So when the Million Man March occurred on October 16th, 1995, that was my first class. That was my first class. I just graduated from Morehouse in May and got the job at Sojourner Truth in August. So that was my first class, and I had all boys. And they wanted me to get on the bus so bad. But I was like, I ain't leaving y'all. Y'all my kids. I'm staying with you. And we watched it on TV. We had another male teacher. He had a male class as well. We brought our classes together, and we watched the Million Man March together. That, too, was also a very important moment because of having those young boys, you know, my first group. And looking in their eyes, and they asking me questions, and, you know, who is Minister Farrakhan, and what is this Million Man March about? And I was like, I couldn't leave and jump on a bus and go out to D.C., and I have these children here. I have this captive audience that's going to ask all these questions. I said, I couldn't leave. So I felt like it was historic for me to be there in that classroom, just as it was historic for all those men and women, because there were women there as well, to go to Washington. And thank God for technology, we were able to bring that march into the classroom and talk about
it. Right, for sure. Yeah, it's just like those opportunities to connect beyond like math, reading, writing, and like, of course you can integrate those, but taking care of like the lived experiences of people, and making those connections, treating them like they're, you know, developing humans who need to be witnesses to all these important moments is super vital to, you know, building relationships, but also just human development and education. You talked about how that was one moment that, well, those were a couple moments that were really impactful for you, but you still haven't learned the word restorative justice at this point. When did you learn the word restorative justice?
I got burned out from teaching. My mentor and my, I felt like I grew a close relationship with her. She died, my principal at the time, died of pancreatic cancer. She struggled. She fought. She didn't just, you know, she struggled and fought. She went through a lot. And that devastated me because, you know, here was a person that gave me this incredible opportunity and she died. And now I had to be in a building with all these different principals with all these, because, you know, after she died, they kind of went through a lot of interims until they found the principal to, you know, lead their school. And I got burnt out. You know, I got burnt out. Just, you know, that zest for it kind of left. But I had the great opportunity to speak to another mentor, Miss Anita President. And Miss Anita President is the sister of Toni Morris, who is the head administrator for the Children and Family Justice Center run by Bernadine Dorn at Northwestern University Law School. And through all my talks with her, we would talk for hours, man. I just show up because she was like a principal at the adjoining Child Parent Center. So when I'd finish my day, I'd go over there to her and we just talk. And through all the talking, she got to know me, I got to know her, and she began to realize that, you know, maybe going into the not-for-profit world may be just right what you need right now. And so she told me about this position that was opening up with the community panels for youth under the Community Justice for Youth Institute. And they said, why don't you throw your resume in and see if that be, you know, an opportunity for you to, you know, transition. And, you know, hopefully this will help you. And so I did. I interviewed. And the interview was crazy. Jeff Banks was the program manager at the time. Cheryl Graves, of course, who's the director, and then Orr Shoup, who's the director. So it was, you know, knowing them, it was something. I was like, what type of place is this? And it was funny, man, I couldn't find my cufflinks. So I had to get some safety pins and, you know, fasten my shirt together. So when I got to the place, I kept my hands right where, you know, I didn't move. I didn't usually talk with my hand. I kept it down. And I told them the joke later. And they said, oh, no, we saw the cufflink. We thought it was some style. I just laughed. And I knew. I was like, yeah, these are my people right here. And so I got the position to be the program manager for the community panels for youth. And the community panels was all about neighborhood accountability board. So it was giving the communities the power to actually deal with the cases. And so they had a relationship with the state's attorney's office at the time. And we would get cases that they felt needed to be diverted. And those diverted cases would then go to these community panels who were trained by Cheryl or and others that were there at Northwestern Children and Family Justice Center to actually do these kind of community panels. And they volunteered. So they would spend those evenings and come, and I would come, and I would be at, you know, I would move around to the different sites throughout the city, you know, and that's how I got to know the city and all these different neighborhoods and stuff, and meet all these great people who gave of their time. Some of them were in churches, some of them were Jewish, some of them were Muslim, some of them were non-denominational, some of them were LGBT, some of them weren't, some of them were heterosexual. It was such a hodgepodge of people, but what, you know, gave them like a, you know, a sense of belonging was the fact that they were helping kids, you know, get pulled out of that system and give them opportunities to follow in this philosophy at the time that I was learning called BARGE, Balance and Restorative Justice. And the three areas at the time that we were looking at were accountability, public safety, and competency development. Community safety, you know, kind of self-explanatory. Accountability was holding that young person accountable for their actions, but not accountable in a harsh way, but with care and with understanding. And then finally, competency development is finding out where that young person was lacking. We also had opportunities to have the victims. If it was victimless crimes, quote unquote, were a lot of the nonviolent drug offenses. So the victim was the community and how that affected the community. But then we had instances where the victim actually showed up. And those were some of the most powerful panels, because those were opportunities for where that young person was able to face that person that they harmed. I remember an instance, I'll never forget it. It was a graffiti situation. So it was vandalism. And this particular person that was harmed was an older woman. And she, you know, spoke very passionately about her home and the fact that she's close to paying it off. And you know, this is like her wealth builder for her family. And, you know, and this whole notion of affecting me and my family just by scrolling some stuff on my you know, garage door. And the young person was clueless, obviously, because what did he know? He lived in an apartment. He didn't know anything about that. He had no clue that writing my little gang symbol on this garage door was affecting this person. Not only fear of the gangs, but also the whole notion of wealth building and buying and home ownership. So there was an area of competency development that we needed to, you know, help that young person understand that. So they put, they got creative and figured out ways to get him that knowledge and information. But at the same time, he then was able to clean off that, you know, that, you know, the gang sign off the person's garage. And then they built up a relationship because they lived in the same community. So they built up a relationship that, you know, we heard like later on, you know, was a benefit for both of them. So that's what we, you know, Cheryl and Orr and their genius was figuring out how we can build relationships from a community standpoint without having the law come with their heavy handedness and just make a mess of everything, right?
Right.
In the whole sense of creating community safety. Well, we'd just be the hammer and just hammer everybody. But that was not the rationale that they felt, I'm talking mm-hmm. about Orr and Cheryl, in their movement toward the community panels. But what moved me back into schools, David, was the instance where there was a huge fight. It was like 40 kids. They arrested all the 40 kids and sent the case to the state's attorney. Well, the state's attorney at the time, she and I had a pretty good relationship. And she was like, I don't want to prosecute all these kids. She said, well, you think we could do a panel or something? I said, 40 kids? I said, well, give them to me and we'll figure it out. Because there were 40 kids from all over the place. It was high school, so they were all over the city. And I realized as we were looking at the cases and looking at what was going on and the children, that not only were children were arrested, but they were suspended for 10 days. And I was like, man, these kids are not going to pass school if they out of school for 10 days. So if we handle what is handled from a legal standpoint, we still got to deal with what's going on in the schools. And that's what kicked us into finding out what was happening in the schools. And it wasn't only happening at this school, it was happening across all the schools, where these children were getting a double whammy when they would get in trouble with the law. They would not only get arrested and have a record, but then they would get suspended for numerous days and they wouldn't be able to get their academics and they would fail. Hence the movement from school to prison, because eventually the children would get to the high school or even the middle school and realize, man, I can't even, you know, I'm so far behind in my education, man, I'm going to go out here and I'm going to hustle. And a lot of children made that move. And of course, once they began to hustle, of course, that moved them into getting interactions with the police and getting locked up. So the whole notion of the school to prison pipeline was happening right under our noses. We didn't even know what was happening until that fight with them 40 kids kind of gave us an awareness that something is going on in our schools and with our justice system. What's happening? And through just some really courageous people were able to give data to the Advancement Project, and they were looking at three specific municipalities, and Chicago was one of them. And someone gave them the numbers, and we saw the numbers, and it was like stark that there's something wrong in our city around our relationship building, around young people, around the justice system. All of it is just wrong. And that activated the Community Justice for Youth and many other organizations all across the city to begin to attack this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what did that look like for you?
Well, that started the activism part, right? Mm-hmm. So we were doing the restorative work with the panels, but then we began to now become more activated and activists and working with the Southwest Youth Collaborative and working with, you know, a variety of different groups all over the city, from the north side to the south side to the west side, because it was a global problem in the city of Chicago. And we were incredibly blessed to have the relationships that we had with the justice system, meaning we had relationships with state's attorneys, we had relationships with judges. Josephia Hall had convened a meet, you know, had been convening a meeting. We were bringing all of the sort of justice practitioners and partners and everyone together to talk about what was going on. And that was a blessing, because that opened up an opportunity for us to have a dialogue with the justice system and to begin to have a dialogue with the Board of Education. And because I was a teacher for those number of years, I was kind of tasked with having those conversations and showing them what restorative justice, you know, could look like. And so what eventually happened is that we came together. Judge Hall brought us all together, the activists and the board, to begin to have these conversations. We had a few little hiccups, and we were convened back again and realized that we were at odds with each other. And one of the members of our team said, you know, we need to do a circle. Now, we had just got trained by Kay Prannis not too long ago. And we know Kay is the restorative justice guru, Living Justice Press, all that good stuff. So we were new to this, but we knew the power of it because we had just went through a few trainings with her. So we were like, man. And so when that came up that we could do this circle, the people in the board had no idea what they were in for. We knew, but they had no idea what they were in for. Right. So for 2 days, we sat in circle. The first day was just storytelling and just getting to know each other and, you know, just getting to know what your mind was at. We had the head of legal, James Beverly, there, and other big wigs were there. It was amazing. And the second day was when we began to do the task of figuring out how to begin to move away as a school system from zero tolerance to restorative justice, with the blessing of the mayor at the time, which was Mayor Daley, because of course that made him look bad. So of course he needed this thing handled and handled as quickly as possible, because it was in the press now that all this was going on. And so after that second day, we were able to come to an agreement that we were going to change the student code of conduct. So that was back in 2007, with the removal of zero tolerance and all its practices and placing in there restorative justice. And that began the process of us moving into the school's work very, 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 you know, more so than what we were doing with the panels. We still were doing panels, but we took on this other work of now training and providing technical support to Chicago Public Schools. So we hooked up with Dr. Inez Drummond and her team, met a lot of great people during that time in terms of their peer jury program, which was happening all throughout, you know, the city. And we saw it was a restorative justice process. And so we began to really, you know, connect with that process. And then we began to do legal, you know, trainings with, you know, the legal department has a training for all of their, you know, principals. And they added us into one of their modules. So it allowed for the principals to be introduced, you know, to restorative justice and why it's important for you to ensure that that was there. We also were doing trainings with teachers all across the district, whether they came to us or we went to them. And it was just just an amazing push. Not only were we pushing on the inside, but it was push on the outside, because there was organizing going on the outside, awakening and bringing awareness to our parents that this was going on, and that you that are members of LSCs have to make sure that, you know, we don't allow this. We can't have this happening, and that we have to move away from this stance of zero tolerance and for the sake of classroom management to a more holistic and more social emotional approach. And restorative justice was and still is the approach that was brought forth to the you know, to the community. And we just kept pushing, And then the downturn hit. The economic downturn hit in 2008, 2009, and the party was over. I was so sad. The party was over because monies got tight. They couldn't pay us, and I got laid off. But when one door closes, another one opens. And so the opportunity for me to be the chief dean at Christian Finger High School, using these things that I've been using, I was given opportunity to do that. And so I transitioned from being the community panels program director to the work of being the chief dean for restorative justice, discipline, and code switching at Christian Finger High School during their 2009, what I've worked, you know, through 2014, but that first year, 2009, 2010, which was a historic year. That was an historic year. That first year is what clearly changed my life and everybody's lives. I was connected to that school because that was the year when the school was being transformed and the school was being shifted and changed, being turned around, as they call it. And we were the turnaround. We were the turnaround team under the leadership of Elizabeth Dozier, who was the principal at the time. Tasha Jackson was the vice principal, so I worked. I was under her directly. But Liz Dozier was the principal of the school, and on September 24th, 2009, was when the big fight ensued. Started at the school, but then it spilled out into the neighborhood.
And for those for people who don't know, can you give a little bit more context to what was going on?
So during that particular school year, the team, you know, wanted a dean, but the deans in the past were all focused on discipline, and that discipline was zero tolerance, suspensions, expulsions, arrests, in the name of creating a safe environment, right? When you talk about the culture of a school, we're looking at three specific things. What does the school practice? What does the school promote? And what does the school permit? And how the leadership shares that is through the ways in which they communicate with their school community. So the Board of Education closed the school in another location on the far south side in a community called Oak Hill Gardens, and sent those children from the Oak Hill Gardens, bused them to Finger. They had just turned the school around, did a lot of new things to the school, and in their wisdom at the time, they felt like we need to get that community, you know, plugged into Chicago, right? And plugged into, you know, the wealth that we have put into the school. New teachers, new principal, new direction. Unbeknownst to me and to a lot of people, there was a rift. There was always a rift between that community and the community that Chicago, Christian Finger High School is located, which was called the Ville. So it was the Gardens versus the Ville. And it was that had been going on for generations. And so now you want to put those children in the same school with each other, knowing that their parents, their grandparents, great-grandparents have been fighting for years. Plus, you had gang issues as well, crossing gang lines and all that. It was just a bad mix. I wasn't aware of the history. I didn't know anything about the community or any of those things. All I knew is that I was tasked with creating a peaceful environment. And of course, I was thinking using what I've been using for those many years, restorative justice would be what we would use. Unfortunately, when you're a dean, and that, you know, that name is so loaded, so they're not expecting you to come and say, here's a rock and a rug, let's sit down and let's talk. And, you know, a few of the colleagues, you know, laughed at me. They were like, man, you crazy. You think you're going to bring that peace circle stuff here to these kids? They're going to beat you upside the head with that rock, and they're going to tie you up with that rug and throw you in the corner. Nobody's going to even listen to you. But I believed in my heart, and there's the warrior in me, that they are, because I believe very strongly in what I did and what I was doing, and I believed in the community I was connected to. And so I began to, bring in restorative justice because that was a part of my work. And so we were doing some of those circles in my office. We had these nice, beautiful wood rocking chairs, you know. So they were already thinking about this. But unfortunately, the children, they weren't taking to it because they felt fear for the other. They didn't know that child, and the child didn't know them. And there was always this animosity between them, you know, between these groups. And I thought I had the power to, you know, bring them together. I thought it was in me to do it. But unfortunately, the hatred and anger and frustration was just too great. Well, it all started because, from what the young people tell me, you know, the girls started liking the boys from the other community. So the boys got a little jealous about that. And then, of course, gang issues and other things started. These rumblings started happening. These little fights and things were happening. And the children were very crafty. They were like, okay, this building is huge, so we want to beat up so-and-so, but we need a diversion. So they would have a made-up fight up in one location in order to get everybody to go that way so they could go over on this side of the building and go beat up whoever they wanted to beat up. I mean, it was just so much stuff was going on. That work that I wanted to do as a restorative justice practitioner was kind of thrown to the wayside. They just wanted me to suspend, expel, and arrest. That was totally not me. I was making it clear it wasn't me. There were moments that I didn't want to do the job, wanted to walk away, but I just felt very strongly that we can make headway, but we got to change how we're approaching these young people. I think we're approaching them wrong. And, you know, the powers that be at the time were stuck on what they were stuck on. This is what works in their mind, and this is what we're going to use, and you're going to do what I tell you to do because, you know, I'm the boss or I'm the leader and you're under me, so you do what I tell you to do. And so fast forward to September 24th, a young man had a fight. And, you know, a group of kids try to jump him. He's from the gardens. These group of kids were from that community. Those kids escaped, but we caught him and maybe one other kid. And I released that young man to his parent at 1:40. I remember that because I saw it. I wrote it down. And so he was gone before school was out. School was out at like 2:15. But when he got home, his mother told him to come back into the community and pick up one of his relatives. And he came back. He saw the kids that jumped him. He, you know, school had let out. He told the other kids, these are the kids that tried to jump me. They all went, met up in a particular location and began to fight. And then the fight just got bigger and bigger and bigger because kids now found out that there was this big fight going on between the garden and the Ville over in this particular location down the street. And so during that time, one of our students walked into that hornet's nest, not knowing that that would be the last time he would be alive. He was just like all other kids, went to see what was going on. And, you know, as I told you, what happened to me when I was growing up in middle school, where the kid fought me only to get another kid that they wanted to get, I think that's what happened with this young man. They saw him, they felt some kind of way about him, and he was a part of their neighborhood, but they didn't like him for whatever reason. Because after they did that, they went after him, and a young lady filmed it, that she videoed it. Little did she know what she was doing. She videoed what was going on and put it up on YouTube, and it went viral. And it was from that moment, this killing of this young man put our school on the national platforms. And, of course, everybody that was a talking head had something to say about Liz Dozier, had something to say about me, had something to say about the school. The parents were in an uproar. Everybody was angry and upset about what happened. Of course, the killing of Darren was just so painful to all of us. We didn't even have time to mourn. It was just like we had to go light speed now to try and deal with what we were dealing with, which was not only dealing with what was going on in the school community, but also what was going on in the community at large, because there was just so much was coming at us. Threats to our lives, and oh my gosh, it was crazy. It was crazy. That was a very stressful time for all of us. And so by just working hard, we got through that year. But the principal had to make a decision about my role. And she realized that, you know, I'm not a good chief dean. But I am good at the restorative justice. Now, how does she know that? Well, she knew that because she saw the type of person I was and my temperament, but she also was getting letters from all of my colleagues telling her that the guy that you have in that building, that's what he does. This is what he's known for. He's an expert in this, and you need to use him to do that, and we'll help you as a community, as a restorative justice community, to ensure that this work is done well. So she was getting all those messages. of course, I was pushing back about how I felt about the job. So she was hearing from me. Of course, my direct supervisor, of course, was talking to her. So she was getting all these messages. And she made one of the most, you know, incredible decisions that any leader can make in my life. And that's laterally moved me from being the chief dean to now creating a whole new position called the culture and climate coordinator. And when she created that position, what she did was she gave me the latitude and the space to really bring in the restorative justice work. And so the first few, you know, days of the work, first thing I did is that my office became the peach room. So that was the room where we were going to do everything restorative. And so then the question was, well, what is that? What does that look like in a high school? Well, I said, we're going to do peace circles. We're going to do restorative mediations. We're going to have a peer jury, where we call them youth ambassadors, who are going to be the tip of the spear for my work, because they were going to be the face of this, and they were going to be the ones in the leadership, the vanguard of this work. We want to have opportunities for the families to come in so we can train them and teach them on this work. Like, my office became the one-stop shop. And what was cool was I had a partner in my office who literally watched what was going on. He participated when he could, but he was over the sports, and he was also a special ed teacher. So whenever he would come into the office and he would see me at work, man, he would be in such amazement, because he knew the kids. He had been at the school for a long time. So he was like, how are you able to get all these children to kind of calm down? How do you, you know, just talking, what are you doing? I'm like, just come and see. And he would come and see, and others would come and see. And I was very thankful that the principal supported me 120%. She would come and sit in circle just to give that extra oomph, like, follow what he's saying, because I don't want you to go this way. So follow what he's saying. And then she would leave, and they would be like, oh, well, if she's behind you, then I guess you're legitimate. And, that began that whole movement. And then we started doing school-wide activities, Peace Month, Peace Week, Day of Peace, peace rallies. You know, she had a budget from this stimulus money from President Obama at the time, so she was using a lot of that money to leverage on a variety of different programs, which included the peace work that we were doing, the peace initiatives. And that work got highlighted in the documentary that featured her, the mayor at the time, and the police chief of Chicagoland. And so, you know, I was a part of it, and others were a part of it in our school, to show the team work that we were using to actually bring about this work in the restorative justice community here in Chicago. As I knew they would, showed up, showed out, supported me, was there. I remember having meetings with them, and I said, look, man, this is not going to happen again, that you have a principal whose ear is to us and want to give our school, want to give this school into the hands of a community that is specifically showing them how to actually work with young people, not from a zero-tolerance stance, but from a restorative stance. This is not going to happen again. I'm telling you, it's not going to happen again. So we got to take this advantage and take this opportunity. And they did. And, you know, I wouldn't be here talking to you if that community didn't wrap their arms around me and got into those spaces with me. When we were doing those peace rallies and stuff, they showed up, showed out, stood with me, legitimized the work I was doing, because there was a lot of people that were like, you crazy, these children are not going to do this. Well, those people went from, you crazy, these children are not going to do this, to now they are culture and climate coordinators in their schools. They're calling me, asking me for stuff, because that they knew that's what I was doing, you know, when there was no culture and climate coordinators anywhere. So that speaks to the transformative leadership of Liz Dozier. That speaks to the incredible movement of the community to say, this is what we want. The community organizing, the restorative justice community was doing outside. And then, of course, the execution that we were doing inside of the school. And I couldn't have done it without the team. You know, Dr. King talks about this whole notion of being the drum major. That I am, right? I was the circle within the square, right? The square being the school and all its policies and everything. But I was a stand for the circle. And eventually that circle fit into the square. It took time. It was hard work, but eventually it fit into the square And then eventually the circle overtook the square and it became what's policy. It became, this is what we do. This is how we operate. This is the culture of Finger. We promote restorative justice. We permit restorative justice and we practice restorative justice. And when that happened, that's when this whole construct of zero tolerance just shifted. Like it just, everybody was like, this is the way that we're going to go, because look at how this is affecting this school right here that we know is traumatized. But 4 years later, look at where they are now. And they credit a lot of the social emotional work that we had done in those years to really get the school to a place where it can actually excel, right? So in June of 2017, they had 100% graduation rate. First time in years that Finger had that, with over, I think, $2 million in scholarships. And, you know, yeah, they're crediting the man who's, principal. But if it wasn't for Liz Dozier and that team before that, those young people wouldn't have got the benefit of being able to get themselves in position to now go to college, which for a lot of them, they're the first ones in their generation and their team, their family to ever go to college. And so when you think about that, that's like the benefits that you can't pay for in being an educator, when you can see a young person actually break through the bonds of poverty and lack and move into a space where they can eventually become middle class, and how they can then from middle class move into higher middle class and eventually move into a space of being rich, and know that the pathway to that was a quality education that was given to them, and the opportunities for being afforded that opportunity with the help of really great leaders and really great teachers that care a lot about them and their upward progression here in America. So, hats off to the team. Hats off to Liz Dozier. Hats off to Tasha Jackson for thinking about us and wanting to hire me. If she didn't hire me, I wouldn't have had this opportunity. And then, of course, the incredible restorative justice community that held my hand and walked me through this fire, this very incredible challenge that we had to overcome, and we did, and yeah, magnified it, as this platform is doing, amplified it to a level that now all over the United States, everyone is trying to capture that lightning in a bottle for their classrooms, for their school districts,
yeah,
across the nation.
Yeah. I think like one of the things that I want to pull out of all of that is like how much dedication it took to this process, how much like, no, this is what we're doing. And not half-assing it, it took, right? Because now that restorative justice is a buzzword in education and in a lot of other spaces, a lot of people are trying to bring in these programs and they're failing, right? They're not doing them well because they don't have the support. They're not dedicating the time and they don't really believe in the work. And I think, you know, restorative justice has a bad name in some places. We can think about like how at the RNC this summer, like restorative justice was blamed for a school shooting. Like both of us know that that's BS, but the work that went into that was so immense. This isn't a quick and easy process. You talked about when you were sitting down with community panels for youth, like this was a days long process, right? It's not just something that like, oh, we had a professional development about it for 2 hours and then like we're good. We've changed all of our culture. You talked about like, you know, what is it, what we allow,
what we practice, what we promote, and what we permit,
and what we permit, right? There's so much that goes into that, and you know, it's borne great fruit in a lot of spaces, and in some places where the word restorative justice are being used, it's not happening to the same level. How does that feel knowing that, you know, you were someone who helped bring this to mass awareness to this movement, but it's watered down in so many places.
Yeah, and that is a concern of mine when I hear the backlash to restorative justice, especially when they blame it on school shootings or any, you know, malfeasance that may happen. That happened to me too, David. That happened to me because there was an expectation that oh, if they go into the peace room, man, this thing gonna be solved because Mr. Spicer got them, right? But some young people needed a little bit more than just what we were doing. I would look at it from a tiered approach, right? When you talk about the superstructure of PBIS, right? You have tier one, which are universal supports, tier two, which are supports that are geared more toward more smaller groups and therapy groups and counseling, and then tier one, which was more one-on-one. And as long as we were on that board, man, we had a chance to move children that were at one down to two and to three, but we also knew that there was a threat that a child would move from the universal to the second tier, the more intensive tier, and then move to the third tier, which is very intensive. And so with that being said, I was very keen and aware of the fact that restorative justice had to be at each tier. Couldn't just be a tier one. We couldn't just use it just a universal support, just do it in homeroom stuff, but then don't attack the little issues that may come up. And then we have to do some one-on-ones with some of our young people that were really traumatized. And we had to do some one-on-one groups and other things. We all, you know, Liz brought in a lot of programming to really attack the tier ones, a program called YAP, where individuals, you know, youth advocate program, individuals would actually mentor and work with the child after school hours when, because they knew during those times there were issues and there were, you know, things that were happening after school. So they needed like a mentor. And so the school paid for this particular mentorship program to really attack those young people that were at a threat of being shot or to be shooters. That's how serious this was. You know, this was life and death. And so to hear that, you know, there are people that are in it to get paid, in it to get celebrity, in it to get seen or anything. Yeah, they do create a situation where it makes it hard for the people that are out here really hustling, really working to really see our nation become a restorative city on a hill. If you want to take it from that poem that Ronald Reagan, you know, often spoke of America during his tenure as president. I just feel like, you know, that's a part of the process. You know, you're going to have imitators, you're going to have fakers, you're going to have haters. All that's just a part of the process. And it's going to be politicized because it was Arne Duncan that wrote the guidance that really kicked in this whole national movement to say, hey, we need to move away from this zero tolerance stance and move more toward a restorative stance. And I worked with the Obama administration on their Rethink Discipline program and spoke at the White House and shared all of this incredible work that we were doing. And it accelerated the work nationally because school districts around the nation were dealing with this disproportionate use of punishment and discipline that affected young people's ability to have a pathway to citizenship, and specific young people at that. You know, it was laser beam who we were targeting. So it was clear that we need to get away from that and get out of that business. But I'm not deterred by it. I'm not deterred when I hear about it. I'm a disciple, as I said earlier in our conversation. And being a disciple is one who's apt to teach. And so I'm a teacher. I'm like, somebody obviously taught you wrong, and that happens. So let me give you the correct teaching. Let me show you exactly how this can be done. I have 25 plus years of wisdom that I've gained over the course of my time and the mistakes that I made and the many mistakes that I made to be able to help, you know, with some of the concerns that people may have about whether restorative justice can work. The question is not whether it works or whether it can work. The question is whether are you willing to put in the work. And you can't fake this. You got to do it. We put in hours and hours and hours of work. People sacrifice all type of time to ensure that this structure was built so strong that it could be replicated all over the United States and the world. And you can't fake this. There's no shortcuts. You got to put in the work. You got to do the work. And you have to be true to this process. If not, don't mess with it, because it's very powerful. And its effect on other people can be life-changing, for good or for bad. For the people out here that are listening that hear some of these negative things about restorative justice, I just want to let you know that you have to check who's telling you this information or who's showing you, you have to check their credentials. You have to see who they are. And if they truly have the understanding of the process, or are they just talking heads, or they just had one bad experience. And because of that bad experience, their whole view of restorative practices and the philosophy of restorative justice is skewed. I would implore people to read, to find experts in this work, to sit with people that have done this work and have had challenges and how they've overcome those challenges. I would encourage people to, get trained in this work, to connect up with different groups that are doing this work all across the nation and in your particular location, and to not believe the hype too, because, you know, there's a lot of hype because of restorative justice, because of the show and other things, is hype around it. But there's a lot of hard work that went into us getting to that point, right? Mm-hmm. If we didn't succeed, you wouldn't be talking to me on this podcast, you know? And there are a lot of people that didn't succeed because they gave up too early. Liz gave me the latitude to be me and to work this program and to also even offer other ways that this program can even touch not only the young people, but also the adults. So we did some circles with adults and issues that were going on. I even did a circle with leadership and certain teachers so that it wouldn't go into the union grievance and all that stuff. And they could actually sit in a safe space and talk as colleagues and figure out how to work better in their particular, in this particular school, you know, community. And when those things worked out, it gave even more, power to bringing restorative justice into other spaces, the ways that it can move into other, you know, realms and really help build relationships. But there's so many different ways to understand how to get there. It's just, you just have to do it. And that's all I can, you know, offer to the listening audience. Don't get caught up in the hype. This is hard work. This is not for everyone in terms of doing it, but it is for everyone that needs it, right? There's many people out here that need it, but not everyone has the temperament or the passion for this work. And you have to have a level of passion, a level of zest, a level of patience to do this work, because it's not going to happen. Like you just said in your introduction to this question, it's not going to happen, you know, and just one little sitting with a little two-hour PD. All right, y'all train now. Go out there and change the world. Man, come on, man. This is years. This is years of work to get to the level that where you feel comfortable and ready to actually lead this on in a very substantive way. That's why I say I'm still a student. And you have to come and approach it that way. Even though you've attained 20-odd years of this work, Rob, I'm still a student. Still learning. I'm still picking up new things, new ideas. I'm still trying to figure out how this can, you know, connect with something else that I'm working on. You know, just a lot of learning that you have to do, as well as the learning in education, because education is moving at light speed, especially with the coronavirus. Now everything's moving to technology. So how can we use restorative justice in a format like this to help our young people and our teachers? And people are trying to figure that out right now, me included, how to move from a, you know, space where we're sitting in a circle and we're all together to doing this, you know, work on a digital platform. And I'm having some opportunities to do that with different clients and different groups, and having to get my mindset in a space where I can understand that there are different ways that we can do this. We can do it this way. We can do it the way we come together and be open to it. And that's so important in the work that we do, because we have no control of the outcomes, right? Like that's not our work. We don't, you know, that's why I would get in trouble, right? They would come in my circle at the school I worked at. They would come in my room. We do a circle, and then everybody would think, oh, well, they went to Spice's room, so it's fine. And then the next period, they go get in the fight. And who they calling in the office? Me. They're like, man, you had 90 minutes with them girls. What? And I'm like, I did everything I could. But, you know, if they choose to do what they want to do, You know, some of them are good actors and actresses, and they know how to, you know, they know the script, they know how to go forward, and still in their mind, they still want to mete out violent justice towards someone. So, you know, I went through a lot of that too, and people not believing in what we were doing. But all you need is one person to believe in you, and that one person is yourself. And then you need another person to believe in you, and that person is your first follower. And once you got that, there's nothing you cannot attain and cannot do in this world for good. And so I have to say that my first follower was Liz Dozier, who was the principal. And without her giving me the stamp of approval and saying I support you, you wouldn't be on this call with me. Because she gave me the platform. She did not have to. She could have hired someone else. She could have let me go and send me back to Cheryl Nora. But she knew that she needed someone on her team to help move the school forward. And she trusted me. And I hope and pray that, you know, people hearing this understand the importance of building that trust with your colleagues in this work. And the trust doesn't come overnight, as you said earlier, right? It doesn't come over no 2 days or 2 hours. No, it comes with you being consistent, setting goals, having discipline, and being clear about the journey that you're going on and being willing to, you know, change at different points, shift at different points. But more importantly, being so willing to accept the power of this work that's well above your own understanding of the work. And knowing that that power is ubiquitous, it's continually moving and shaping and forming everything that's happening around you like water. And Bruce Lee said it, right? Be like water. Be as powerful as water, but also be as soft as water. But be like water. And also take on the shape of where you are. Water is, you know, Bruce Lee, bless his heart. God bless him. Those words are so powerful and so profound. And I feel like that's what restorative justice did. It washed the community of all of its fears and traumas and put them on the right footing that prepared them for the new day that we're moving into.
Yeah. Talking about Bruce Lee, Pamela Purdy often talks about him as well, right? Who was also on the podcast a little bit ago, as well as Cheryl, who's the very first episode of this podcast. But I think one of the things about Bruce Lee, and it goes back to what your friend was saying about, you know, like the samurai, or like Bruce Lee was like, you know, like I would rather be, you know, a farmer, like who knew how to fight than, you know, a warrior. Oh man, I'm messing up that quote. But like, again, like that idea of taking the shape of where you are, but being able to move in different places. You are not at Finger anymore. Tell us about the transition out of there and what you're doing now.
Well, so just like with the Community Justice Youth Institute in 2008, 2014, the school shifted. I was under the stimulus money, and so that money ran out. And so the principal had to make a decision, and one of the decisions was to, you know, lay people off, and I was a part of that. They raised a little bit of money to keep me for a little bit, you know, past the time that, you know, they said they were going to lay me off. And she wanted me to come and work part-time. And, you know, I had a kid in college at the time, and wife and two beautiful daughters and two dogs. Didn't have the third dog yet. And I was, you know, not going to do this work part-time, because I felt like it needed to be valued. Like, we just finished the show and all this stuff, and then you're going to put me on part-time work? Like, I should have a corner office someplace, man. We helped get this school off this situation, you know, shouldn't there be a promotion? And the answer was no, there was no promotion. Remember, there was no culture and climate coordinators at other schools or anything. It was like, this was new. So it was not like I can go from Finger and go into another school and be a culture and climate coordinator there. And they didn't have that position in their budget. So I made a decision, and that decision was to not come back for that next school year. I wrote a nice note thanking her and walked out into the sunset. And so when I made that decision, though, I didn't have anything else. You know, I didn't have anything to go to. And I was a little upset about that and went into a little depression. And my wife, you know, saw me, saw what was going on. And she's an accountant, so she's in the financial world. And so she came to me and she said, you know, have you ever heard of a consultant? And I said, nah, I never heard of a consultant. She said, well, consultants, they go to businesses or go to places and they give people your knowledge and they get paid. I said, oh, okay. She said, well, I think your consultant name should be Restorative Strategies. I got it in the system and I got your EIN number. I said, what's that? She said, well, that's your number that gets you paid. It's like your Social Security number to your business. I said, oh, okay. And she said, I got your business card through Vistaprint. You don't mind, I went and got it. So we can start, you know, you can get off this bed and you can start working, right? Because she was out of work at the time and I was out of work at the time. And so I began to, you know, rethink how this was going to happen. Like, I had one thought that I was going to be rewarded by the system. And what ended up happening was that I promoted myself from being a chief dean and being a culture climate coordinator to being the CEO of my own company, my own consulting company. I had a different thought process. I thought somebody was going to promote me when that wasn't the case. I promoted my wife and I, we promoted ourselves,
right,
and decided that this work needed to go out here into these incredible schools throughout the United States. What gave me the confidence, David, what really gave me the confidence was being invited to the White House and being in the Eisenhower office building and sitting in those rooms and hearing Valerie Jarrett and hearing other dignitaries and seeing Arne Duncan, who was preparing to come back to Chicago to start his Chicago Cred program around dealing with the violence. And just being in that space, right? This was President Obama's, I think it was close to his final term, at the end of his final term. And just being in that space and being with all those educators who wanted to see a difference, to see a change, and then being asked to be a part of their restore discipline process and taking that and training, you know, throughout the United States. It gave me and my wife that confidence that we could actually do this full time. And so from 2014 to now, I've been consulting with schools and school districts throughout the United States. I worked with the Syracuse school district for a number of years, about 5 years. And that came based upon my going to D.C., but also speaking at different conferences and being keynote at different places, because the Chicagoland show kind of put me out there. People were, you know, really interested in hearing what I had to say personally based upon my experience. And so I was getting a lot of gigs just to go speak at different conferences throughout the United States, which was cool. But then from those speakings, schools and school districts would come and approach me and say, can you come and help us at our school? Can you come and come to our school district? And so that's what began to kick off the consulting business, full steam ahead. My wife functioned as the CFO, dealing with all the financial matters. And I focused specifically on the training and technical support and coaching that I was giving to the schools and school districts throughout the nation. And travel from coast to coast, south to west, north to south, and amazing people that I've had the opportunity and chance to meet, and the children too, just amazing, and their need for and their desire for, you know, having a different way of dealing with their issues. And as I told you, this was a national problem. It wasn't just in Chicago. It was all over the United States that zero tolerance was the way in which discipline was meted out. And they wanted to change and move away from that. So what tickles me, David, this tickles me, is getting a call from one of my former colleagues who was security. He was the lead security at the school with Finger at the time. And now he's the culture and climate coordinator at one of the high schools here on the South Side. And he called me up and was asking me for advice because he had to do a presentation. That's not like his strong suit. But he knows that I do these presentations. It's nothing for me. So he was like, could you give me some pointers and tips? And I was like, I can't believe that you're the culture and climate coordinator. That's number one. Not because I don't think you can do the work, but just that the school district has embraced, after 10 years of what we had done, has the school district, this third largest in the nation, has embraced having culture and climate coordinators be paid, have paid positions in the school community, as opposed to a grant that could run out. And I'm most proud of that, because a lot of times being a restorative justice practitioner, money is always elusive at different points. And that is
especially now with COVID.
Especially now, definitely. So you're having to be creative to figure out how to make money, and sometimes take on another position, sometimes take two positions, just so that you can keep the lights and the gas and the heat and everything on at your house and keep that comfortable, so that you can actually go out and actually do the work that you're doing. So, I love what I do. I love training. I love teaching. My classroom, David, has gotten larger. That's how I look at it. Like, it was a little schoolhouse in a little room, or in the case of Finger, it was a school building. But now I'm having conversations with superintendents and board members and you name it, and voters and good people, teachers and young people. And they all have a desire to want to learn what I taught at the school. And I'm really, excited about the pause that we're in. Because once this pause is released and we get back to our life, we're all going to come into this new age or this new space with newer skills, with a deeper understanding of the value of our life, the fragility of life, the importance of the purpose that we've been placing this earth to do, the know-how and awareness of money, and making sure that to understand it's not what you make, is what you keep. Being able to make sure you have emergency funds saved up, make sure that you have a budget, make sure that you're doing, on both sides, business as well as your home budget, make sure that your fiduciary, your mentality is more understanding of that, because the work can be so incredible, but we have to be understanding of the details that have to be taken care of, the details financially, but also details health and mental health as well. So, it's very important that as you're evolving into this work and understanding this work, that you're willing to learn new things. And being a consultant, there's so many things that you have to be aware of. One paramount is not only the money you're earning and the money keeping, but the money that must go to the government. Making sure that you have a good tax person that can take care of that, so that you don't have to worry about that. Taxes are paid, and then you can continue to do the work you're doing as a consultant if that's what you want to do. But even, with COVID, I think the thinking right now is to adjust, to pivot. I call it the COVID pivot. We're still doing what we're doing, but we've had to pivot. We had to move in a different direction, kind of like the crossovers that you see the basketball players do. They're going in one direction, and all of a sudden they cross. They go a whole nother direction, and you're still going that direction. That man already done went, or woman already went the other way and is going to the hoop and getting the score. And that's my thinking, right? What crossover move do I need to do with COVID so that I can continue to reach the goal that I'm trying to reach, whatever that goal is that I'm trying to reach or you're trying to reach, those that are listening. Know that there are many different ways to get to the goal. You just have to be willing to adjust And I think that's what all of us have, I hope, are doing or have done over these last 7 months.
What is that goal for you?
Well, I think the ultimate goal, like the Uber goal for me, is to work myself out of a position.
This is seven generation work. I don't think that's going to happen in our lifetimes, but
get to that point where I can actually retire and, as Prince said, right before he died, listening to Esperanza Spalding play beautifully one night, and he was receiving an award, and he gave her his due to her. But basically what he said was, you know, music is in good hands, right? The young people, the next generation. Barack Obama said the same thing before he left when everything was happening, and he said he talked to his children and, of course, children all across the nation. He said, no, listening to them, everything's going to be all right. And he has full confidence in the young people and the youth. So my ultimate goal is to get this work to as many people and get this work into many hands as possible, using the digital platforms as well as physically interacting with people, to the point where we have a critical mass. Talk about COVID and wanting to get to herd immunity, where, you know, it gets COVID's everywhere, so again, no way to where else to go. I want to see it get to that point where that is what we do in this nation. I want our nation to get off of war footing and to promote peace throughout the world. Still be a defense, right? Like Captain America, right? Still have that shield. So if you, I can defend, but I can also beat you up with the shield too, but not be in a position where we have to feel like we're the police of the world, but that we can influence the world through our words, our deeds, our ways of being, but not through war, not through dropping bombs and using research and development to focus in on how we can attack Iran or attack North Korea or attack Russia, but to create avenues for peace with an awareness that we have enemies, but we have a way through our different techniques to even convert our enemies into our friends. And using that, I had a guy that worked on Chicagoland shared with me that there were some issues between the aldermen and one of the mayors. And so he was at the news conference and he said, hey, mayor, I know you and this particular alderman have an issue. In Chicago, the aldermen are like the little mayors. They're the city council. And then you have the mayor. And so he said, hey, why don't you guys do a peace circle? And she laughed at him openly in front of everybody. Ha ha, peace circle, right? Oh, so-and-so is asking me to do a peace circle. Isn't that something? And so he got, you know, offended. Like, you don't know about the peace circle? Okay, I got something for you. So he contacted Liz. Liz, and, you know, Liz was like, I'm not, you know, the person. I think you need to contact Rob. And so he contacted me. I spoke to him about, you know, the peace circles and their effects. And then he wrote an article, you know, in the press about how there needs to be these peace circles. He called them political peace circles to kind of deal with some of the issues that are going on with city council and the mayor on these different issues. And one of the things I said was, you know, they laughed at me too. They laughed too. And they will laugh at you when they first see this crazy thing of a rock and a rug. Of course they're going to laugh at you because this is weird. This is different. But if you stay true to it, they're not going to laugh at you. As a matter of fact, they're going to want you to train them. And they're going to want to know how, you know, some cases, how do I make money doing this? Because you're making money doing this. You seem to be having a ball. And I want to be able to have a ball and make money. So, hey, can I learn how to do this and be a trainer and train other people? You know, so, you know, it's very funny, the evolution of people, right? First they laugh at you, then they want you to hire them. You know, that's the progression. That is going to happen.
I'm just looking up this article right now.
You know?
Yeah. I just found the article.
Oh, you just pull it up. Yeah.
That would be something.
Yeah, and a lot of people that read the article, they were like, you know, man, you know, it'd be great if the mayor listened and actually sat in a circle with you or with a practitioner with this particular alderman. I said, yeah, that would be great, but, you know, I don't think she's going to do it, but it's okay. this guy from the press felt it was very important to let her know and let the public know, don't laugh at this. This not only works, it worked, but not only did it work at one point, it works now, if you're willing to do it. And then, of course, I spoke about the effect that she would have as the mayor to say, I'm willing to sit in a circle with somebody that I'm in adversarial relationship with because I want to be able to meet them at a point where we can come to consensus. What power that would exemplify of her as a mayor. And this is what I'm saying about the end goal for me, that America could get to the point where their power is not because of how many bombs they have, but how many peace restorative justice opportunities and talking pieces they have. And, you know, instead of, you know, the hurt that America can promote, why doesn't the culture of America promote healing? And I believe it can do that. But it can only do that with the power of the people pushing the government and or replacing those that are in government with people that are willing to move our nation toward a space of being promoters of peace. Wouldn't it be great to not only have a Justice Department, but have a Department of Peace? And that Department of Peace would be focused on how to use the weight and the power of the American people to promote peace all over the world, as well as the UN. UN does it, but look at America itself saying, we're promoters of peace. We ain't promoting a war. We're going to promote peace to the umpteenth level. Just like I made a decision, the nation can make a decision too. To say we're not going to promote wars and sending our best and brightest overseas to die in countries far away where people don't even speak English and don't even know America, or don't even care. You know, can we promote peace and stave off a lot of this stuff where people would want to go to violence by promoting peace and using that? So that's like my end goal that I want to see happen, whether it's 7 generations out. I don't know. I won't be here when generations out. But while I'm here, I would love to see restorative justice enter the halls of power. It's entered the halls of power in Illinois with the election of Juliana Stratton, the first African-American female lieutenant governor. And she was, you know, and still is a part of the restorative justice community before she jumped into politics. She was right there in that little room with us, sitting down on that little blue couch, talking to us, and she went to the rally. She helped us put up the peace wall down there at Finger. She was right there. And now that she's reached this high level in her political career, she's using her space to promote restorative justice and to try and begin to move away from this zero tolerance stance that our state has been on. And, you know, if that can happen, man, no telling what can happen if we continue to keep being true to this work and being true to our ideals and true to the work that we're doing. So that's it in a nutshell. But also always in my head is making sure that I can provide, you know, financially for my family and figuring out a way to do what I'm doing to provide for my family. I have a son who's, he's home now, but he was at Tennessee State University. So he's still there, but he's doing online, you know, teaching. And then I have my 2 daughters who are here. My oldest, she's moved out and, you know, living her life. She's about to go into law school. So I'm so proud of her. The family's expanding and growing. But I still got to make sure that everybody's taken care of and lights stay on and heat still in the building and all that good stuff. And as well, throw some money, you know, for savings and, of course, for retirement. And, that's very important to me because it should be, because the work that we do should be valued and it shouldn't be, you know, people shouldn't scoff at it because it's important work and it's needed work. And we see it now, even more so today, how important, how needed it
is. Yeah, absolutely. We're coming up on 2 hours on here, so I want to transition us out into some of the quick hitters to get us out. You already kind of answered the question about, like, what's one place or situation you wish people really knew this work with, you know, the halls of power, government, Chicago mayor's office. As unlikely as that is, it would be beautiful to see. But there are lots of ways to do that. What is restorative justice to you? Can you give it a definition?
Restorative justice to me is simply how we should act toward our children. When our children make mistakes, we're not ready to suspend them, right? We're not trying to expel them from our family, nor are we trying to arrest them, right? We do everything in our power to try and restore that young person back to his or her rightful place after they've made a mistake. Because we want them to learn from their mistakes so that they can teach others. So if we have that attitude where it comes to restorative justice, or for me, the defining thing is how we operate with our children, then we can probably see them operate as adults using restorative justice. So it's how we operate with our children that ensures 7 generations out that we have a restorative mindset. And when I mean mindset, I mean be willing at all times to try and meet that other person where they are, to build relationship, to move us hopefully where we want to be. If the decision is not to move any further, then amicably and with love, you know, like I said earlier, you can't eat at my table, but that doesn't mean I don't want you to eat. I want you to live, I want you to survive, I want you to move forward. We just decided to part. And that doesn't mean people can't come back together. But if your willingness is to understand that there are harms, and that through those harms there are, needs that need to be met, and then from those needs there need to be obligations of who's going to repair the harm. These are the things that we should be doing with our children. Now, did I grow up in a household that did that all the time? No, I didn't. That's because they promoted a different way of raising children, because they came from a different culture. But I believe strongly that this is something that I personally want to see happen in all families, where we in our heart can restore our children. I'm a big Star Wars fan. I love Star Wars. I should have said that in my little 7 things. I'm a Star Wars person. I've been watching The Mandalorian. That baby was getting me mad, because it was eating the eggs and it was doing stuff. That's a spoiler if you didn't see it. But
I haven't watched season 2 yet.
Yeah, if you see the second episode, it's really good. They're all good. It's a Western, spaghetti Western of Star Wars. It's really good. But the baby was getting on my nerves, and you'll see when you watch it. I wanted to get that baby, and then I realized, wow, look at that. That's not how you do, because he didn't do that, but I wanted to get him. I was like, you keep doing what I tell you to do. But, well, he's a Star Wars fan, and of course, the great lesson in Star Wars is the redemption of Darth Vader, or the redemption of Anakin Skywalker. The whole story is about his redemption. He started out good, and then he fell. And he fell further than anybody could ever imagine, anybody could ever understand. And his fall hurt so many people. But before his end came, and before he died, he was restored. He was brought back from being where he was to now being where he was supposed to rightfully be all this time.
This is a whole nother podcast where we're breaking down restorative justice themes into Star Wars. There's so many.
I'm trying to tell you. So I look at that story. I'm like, and we know where the helmet comes from, right? That's the German helmet that Darth Vader wears, right? We know what George Lucas was trying to put out there now. He was talking about the evil empire, right? But we know what was evil in the 40s. And then Darth Vader exemplified that, right? The whole empire did. But he showed that there was a way back, and it was through his children. His child, his son, helped him to come back. And I look at that and I'm like, if that's not restorative justice, I don't know what it is. Right? This is redemption right here. If you can't understand all 6 of the movies and the expanding universe with all the other stuff going on. But what's beautiful about seeing those connections as a restorative justice practitioner is bringing those stories into circle to people that may not even be aware that all that lightsaber and all that special effects is really a story about a family that had a family member do some bad stuff, How many of you can relate to that? Everybody can relate to that. They got a family member that's done some bad stuff. An uncle, a father, a mother, a grandfather, whoever. But the family had to go get that person and restore them. The family had to get them. Nobody could get them but that one cousin or that one dad or that child. Nobody else could. It was a family issue that only the family can deal with. And it was the family member that had to go get that one to bring him back and say, I got to bring you back. I love you too much. It makes me emotional thinking about it, but I love you too much. Instead of all the bad you've done, my love for you and that connection to you is endless. And I'm going to do everything I can in my power to restore you. Look at all of the men and women that have been locked up or are part of the justice system that have to come home, right? That are coming home. They want to know that they're coming home to a family. It's not going to judge them for the things they did wrong. But know that they did their time. They paid their penance. Now, restore me. What does that process look like in a family? What does it look like in a community? What does it look like in a nation? What does it look like in the world? That's the work that we're in. That's the work that I'm involved in. And that's what I want to continue to be involved in until that day when I see it being a part of the culture, what we practice, promote, and permit as American citizens and as global citizens. Mm.
Dang. I kind of just want to leave it on that, but we have a couple more questions that we typically get out on. You get to sit in a circle with four people. Who are they and what do you talk about?
Four people alive or dead?
Living or dead.
Okay, good. One person that I definitely want to sit in a circle with that's dead is Abraham Lincoln. The reason why is because of all the presidents and all the people on this earth and this planet that has lived, I want to just sit under him and just listen to him and his stories and his understandings of how he evolved from being a man that wanted slaves to go back to Africa to then now inviting Frederick Douglass and calling Frederick Douglass his friend. What was that journey like for you, Abraham Lincoln? Number two would be my grandfather on my mother's side, Winnick Edwards, who I realize that I'm a lot like in a lot of different ways. My mother and my grandfather didn't have a good relationship, but before he died, he came to the Americas, came to America, came to our home and stayed. And I just remember the moments sitting with him and talking to him and how beautiful it was to be with my granddad. And I'd love to just sit in a circle and just have him just share the stories of, you know, all the different, you know, adventures that he had as being a business owner, getting into politics in Guyana, writing a book about the history of Guyana. I mean, all the things that I am, I see a lot of me in him. But I didn't have the opportunities to really be with him because of the disconnect that my mother and him had for so many years. But he's here with me in spirit. Number three would be Aura, because I just miss my friend. And I just want to be with her. She ain't got to say nothing. Just sit there and just smile, and with the way she smiles and laughs, and just want to be with her. And finally, the fourth person that I'd like to be with and sit in circle would have to be the former president of the United States, Barack Obama. One reason why I want to be with him or sit in circle with him would be to gain some wisdom and understanding of his journey from his perspective. Number two, understand his journey as it relates to him being a dad, being a father. And then number three, understand it relate to his journey as being a husband. And so I just want to have that kind of, you know, length, width, and breadth of all four of those individuals. Three of them being, you know, deceased, and then one being living.
There you go. It'd be a fire circle.
Man, it's gonna be impactful too, boy. It'll be hours. Yeah, those two men and those three people in there. But those people.
You kind of touched on it before, but what's one thing you want everybody listening to this podcast to know?
I want them to know that I'm working on a project that came to me when I had the opportunity to work with Fania Davis, the sister of Angela Davis, at her organization called Our Joy. They had me come and do an all-male circle. And during that time, I was in that circle with all these incredible thinkers and all these incredible men. What came out of it was a new direction that I feel is a part of the restorative justice movement, and that's aspirational justice. It's something new that we're creating and working on, but it's specifically geared toward meeting the needs of the African American, but also the European American as well, and also other groups throughout the nation. This whole focus on the healing that I feel that needs to happen as our Gen Zers are talking more about dismantling structural racism, aspirational justice is all about that. There are three aspects to aspirational justice as we're working through it. The symbolic, the institutional, and the tangible. And just real quick in a nutshell, the symbolic is dealing with the symbolic structures that are out here that are not bringing our nation together but are tearing us apart. The institutional, focusing on changing and also creating new institutions that are focusing on reintegrating, reimagining, and creating a rebirth of our relationships. And then finally, the tangible, which speaks specifically to not only financial reparations, but also a restorative mindset of how we can repair our relationships as a nation when it comes to the African American. And that came out of a question that was brought up about our relationship to America. And when I say our, I mean African Americans. Because I'm a restorative justice practitioner, I'm often thinking about the history of the African Americans here in America. And the question that always comes to my mind is, has African Americans ever had a good relationship with the American government? And the answer is no. It's enshrined in the Constitution that we were 3/5 a person. So we've never had a good relationship. We always had a relationship that was built on a domination of and a domination of the people as slaves and an extraction of wealth from the people through labor. And so I feel like aspirational justice is the direction that I'm evolving to. It's like hip hop, gospel, jazz, blues, like they all come out of the same tree, right? And so I feel like aspirational justice is just a branch that's connected to the larger tree of restorative justice. Because as an African-American practitioner, I just feel that it's very important that we be clear that African-Americans to the American society or to the American government don't need restorative justice. We need aspirational justice. We need something new that's going to really speak to the needs. And so we're developing that right now. And stay tuned when the book comes out. Hopefully I can talk about it more. But that's it in a nutshell. And I'm really happy to have the opportunity, be given the opportunity to share about this incredible work of restorative justice and also the new work that is a part of the quarantine process. Having time to think and having time to kind of, you know, really process. You know, what all is going on has afforded me an opportunity to look at a new direction that the restorative justice work can take that speaks to us as human beings and speaks to our journey as American citizens.
When is that book coming?
Looks like it's going to be the beginning of March. I'm going to do it through Living Justice Press, so they have to do their scan of it. The manuscript's almost done, and then they're going to look at it and edit and do all the stuff they do. And, you know, so
we'll have to have you back for that.
Yeah, sometime early March will be the time where we're going to roll the book out, and I'll do my little media tour, talk to people, and try and see if we can get this book, you know, on the bestseller list with New York Times, you know, all that good stuff, you know, just try to do something or just get it into hands of as many people as possible to begin to speak to what's going on out here and to have a platform for those that have African-American descent or African descent to say, yeah, this also is connected to the restorative justice work, but we are aware that there are bigger things. Like we talk about when I do circles and I do it with African Americans, and I'm like, this is great. But the question that always comes up, this is what led me to writing this book, was what are we restoring our children to? You know, we do all these great circles and all this great work in the school, but there's still structural racism. There's still institutional racism. There's still poverty. There's still the wealth gap. There's still all of these, you know, situations that our young people have to face, and it's not their fault. It's not their fault. This was generationally created, and we can generationally put it back right, 7 generations out. Well, we have to make a stand now, and I feel that aspirational justice is that stand to really bring light to it. So, yeah.
So you said it's Fania working on it with you. Who else is? Are there other people contributing?
Fania is who inspired it.
Oh, okay. Because
inviting me to be in that circle and sitting in a room with all those incredible men, and one specific man, Wade Nobles, who's an African American psychologist with an understanding of African thought. The things he was saying in that circle was like, man, this. And I heard of him because I've studied, you know, African psychology in my HBCU at Morehouse, and he came across my, you know, reading list and stuff. But it was the first time I actually sat in a room with him. And so it was like sitting with, you know, in African culture, we call our elders the man Baba, right? So we were sitting with Baba Nobles. And in the African culture, your elders are held in high esteem. And he didn't even have to say much. Just him being in the room was like enough to raise the consciousness and awareness in the room of what's possible. And so, yes, I can directly connect. Like, where did aspiration come from? I have to give respect to being in that circle.
Yeah, absolutely. Man, this was so great. Where can people support you and your work? We'll link everything in the description, but tell the people what you got going on.
You could find me on most of the social media platforms. Just put my name in, Robert Spicer. That's Twitter. That's Instagram. And of course, that's Facebook. My website is www.restorativestrategies.expert. There where you can find out all about the stuff that we're doing, and as well get incredible information about the aspirational justice work that we're about to launch. And if you want to reach me by phone, you can contact me on my business line. That's 312-600-7868. And you can call that between 9 and 5 Central Standard Time.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much, Robert, for being here. Hoping to have you back when you got that book out. There's going to be, I already know there's going to be so much in that. I'd love to see an advanced copy.
We're going to throw that to you.
I want you to
read it so we can talk about it.
Yeah, we'll definitely get that going. Thank you so much for your time, your wisdom, your stories. This is definitely going to be the longest podcast we've aired so far, but definitely worth it for everybody who's stuck it through with us this so far. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll talk to you next week. Like what you heard? Please subscribe, rate, review, and share this podcast on whatever platform you're using right now. It really helps us further amplify this work. You can also support us by following us on our social platforms, signing up for our email list, rocking our new merch, joining our Patreon, or signing up for a workshop. So many options! Links to everything in the show notes and on our website, amplifyrj.com. Thanks so much for listening. We'll talk to you next week.